Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, A.H. Malcolm, at A.H. Malcolm on Twitter, of course, and over at RedState.com, where he's a VIP columnist and has lots of great stuff. Andrew, great to have you back.
Yeah, good to be here. It must be Monday then.
Must be Monday.
Tuesday. Monday for Tuesday. Tuesday.
So we're letting the secrets out. We record on Mondays. I think it's the worst kept secret in podcasting. We record on Mondays. It goes up on Tuesdays. look, I mean, at least I'm not changing your answers, right? Post-production. You know, I have to say that we talked about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago when it happened, right? Which was that the 60 Minutes changed the answer to a question that they asked Kamala Harris after they promoted the interview with the original answer that she gave.
Everybody
flagged it and said, why are they changing the answer out? Why was this a different answer than what they had in the promo clip? And we kind of expected some form of contrition. Oh, well, that was an error on our part. We shouldn't have done it. Our bad. Something, right? 60 Minutes comes out, I guess it was last night, but I saw it this morning, that basically says, oh yeah, we always edit people's stuff for clarity and to make them more succinct. We just featured a different part of her answer in the interview, and shame on you for noticing it and calling it a scandal. And by the way, we could have interviewed Trump, but he didn't want to interview with us. It's like, okay, so you're admitting that you did it. You're implying that you did it because Donald Trump wouldn't do an interview with you. And where is this, journalistically speaking?
Well, these people, these TV people, they edit stuff for length all the time.
Yeah.
And they get you. We've caught NBC tricky cutting out, cutting out the middle of a quote to make it shorter, but it also changes the meaning.
What they're doing is that they're editing for meaning rather than for...
Yeah, exactly. And that's unethical, unprofessional. And actually, that's part of my point in the Sunday column that we can talk about later. But it's very disappointing. CBS used to be the gold standard of TV news. When I first got into national reporting back in the 70s, I mean, those guys were real pros, and they had famous people right out of World War II, longtime pros, but they also had sharp younger people who were working for the tradition and the reputation. Boy, has that gone down the toilet.
Yeah, I want to talk about their claim here. I'm just going to read from their statement. I'm going to do something here that, I'm going to read. I'm going to read a passage.
Are you going to shorten it in?
So let me demonstrate how that works. It says 60 Minutes gave an excerpt of our interview to Face the Nation that used a longer section of her answer than that on 60 Minutes. Same question, same answer, but a different portion of the response. When we edit any interview, whether a politician, an athlete, or a movie star, we strive to be clear, accurate, and on point. The portion of our answer on 60 Minutes was more succinct, which allows time for other subjects in a wide-ranging 21-minute long segment. So let me edit that down. 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes used a section of our answer that was different. When we edit any politician, it's to be more succinct, it's a 20-minute segment.
Because we don't have time for word salads, and so we wanted to make her sound better by making a more relevant portion of an answer.
This is part of the problem, is that it's not their job to make her more succinct. That's her job. To make her more succinct. Their job is to ask the question and to do the answer. And if you need more than 21 minutes, take up more than 21 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. This
or if you want to drill down to 21 minutes, then you take out question and answer pairs to get to that.
This fealty to the clock just annoys the heck out of me. It's television. I guess radio does it too, but you know, you got something on the presidential election is, well, we've only got in the debate, we've only got 30 seconds left. How do you make for world peace? No, you know, who said it has to be 90 minutes? It could be 91 and a half. When the president gives the State of the Union, it goes between 92 and 67 minutes, and they let them go. You know, they don't say, well, we'll come back when he gets to something more interesting. No, you can't do that. So obviously it was to eliminate the word salad and make her sound better. That's the only logical, authentic explanation. And
well, you're right. And here's the other part of that problem is if it was anything else, they'd release the transcript.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
They've released the transcript when they the full unedited transcript when they interviewed Trump before. They've done it with Jerome Powell, Catherine Herridge, who used to be a CBS News reporter up until a couple of months ago when they cut her loose while she's in the middle of a First Amendment case, has, you know, notes. But well, here's where they've released full transcripts and they're not doing it here, and they really need to do it. My estimation of the reason why we're not going to see those transcripts is it's going to show other edits where they made her more succinct, only we just didn't know about it.
And more intelligent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, I don't have a problem with edited interviews. I really don't. I get why you do it. But those edits have to be honest and fair. And
well, we do it in print. In the column I mentioned on Sunday, you would interview somebody. Now, this is my early days, so we didn't have tape recorders. We had notebooks. And if you were, you had to scribble. So afterwards, you might check with the subject. Is this a correct quote? Or you might call them back later and read them the quote, not the story. I'm not going to let them see the story in advance, but I'll read them the quote I chose to use. And they can say, well, and I don't mind if they change it then, because I want it to be right more than I want to get somebody.
Right.
And so this is just very, not surprising, unfortunately, but very disappointing.
Well, and again, you're writing about, I want to talk about this in terms of the McDonald's thing too, by the way. There's a slightly more fun thing in terms of media ethics with the McDonald's thing, the Trump McDonald's thing. But I mean, you wrote about it's not that hard for the media to cheat.
Yeah.
And you know, and again, I think it is not hard for the media to cheat. And I think you're seeing the effects of this, right? I just finished up writing a post. It's going to go up later on Monday night. It'll be up by the time the podcast comes out about polling results, right? And I'm talking about polling results in several different contexts, but I talk about the favorability numbers. And here's where I think you can see this. And I mean, this is not news. Everybody's seen this already, but I mentioned the fact that Kamala Harris's favorability numbers were hard underwater for three solid years. And I'm not talking about close. I'm talking about a wide gap. Her positive number was below 40% for most of the time. Her unfavorables were higher than 50% for three solid years. When did that change? Just about the day she got anointed to be the Democrat nominee. And then all of a sudden, the media coverage of her changed, and that changed perceptions of her. Now, she's still, at this point, just tiny, kind of barely underwater, like less than a point. I mean, basically, it's a half and half. But that changed because the media coverage changed. And I want you to think about that in terms of what you wrote about the media cheating, because I think that's part of the media cheating.
Yeah, oh, sure it is. Sure it is. I'm going to pull the curtain down because I'm getting a funny light here.
Oh, I thought you were going to become Wizard of Oz. Attention to the man behind the green curtain.
Yeah, right. It's just so disappointing. I guess maybe I was naive, but I don't recall, and I was behind the scenes for years, this kind of cheating going on. I'd be at an event and I'd see it reported, and they might have a different tack than I did, but it wasn't inaccurate.
Or dishonest. And,
yeah, dishonest, that's a better word. It wasn't. But this changed, and I won't get into all the details in the column, but I was looking at the reasons why media has lost, I think, virtually all trust. Part of it had to do with Watergate, which was a wonderful story, a very important expose by the Washington Post. They had a whole bunch of reporters, but Woodward and Bernstein were the two main ones. They did a heck of a job, and the rest of the media was trying to catch up. And a generation of journalists came along, and then the movie and the book. And a next generation of journalists came along, and they wanted to be famous too. But that's the wrong the wrong ambition. You want to be a reporter and tell a good story, but you have to be honest. And they just wanted to be famous. And so in 1981, the Washington Post published this very touching portrait of an inner city boy by Janet Cook. I mean, she wrote the story, and she got a Pulitzer Prize for it. And it turned out the little boy did not exist. She made up the whole thing. And then along 2003 came Jason Blair, a New York Times reporter, and he wrote, I think, over or almost 600 stories for the New York Times in a very short time, 4 years. He started out as an intern, and they found that the ones they investigated, nearly 100, were fraudulent, made up, or whatever. He wrote interviews. Remember that Army soldier, the Jennifer, who got rescued by the special ops guys?
Yes.
So he wrote an interview about her. He never left Brooklyn. He just made the whole thing up.
Or Stephen Glass, for that matter, right? I mean, the whole Stephen Glass thing over at the New Republic, Republic actually fessed up to. I mean, they actually did a good job of fessing up.
The New York Times assigned five reporters, and they went through dozens of his stories, and they found these things. And it was a very honest, and I'd link to it, a very honest report exposing. But here's why did that happen? And nobody really looked into it. And my theories are, one, there was a generation of journalists that came along that just wanted to be famous, and they wanted to fix society. Well, that's not why the previous generations of journalists got in to the business. They wanted to tell good stories. And they were typically from working class families. After Watergate, these guys went to Ivy League schools, and they came out, and they, of course, were progressive. They came out, they wanted to write stories to fix society. And then it became, in the late 90s, objectivity was kind of old-fashioned if you try to play fair. Now, perfect objectivity is impossible, okay?
Right, yeah.
I worked on it very hard, and I cite in the column Sunday, I wrote a story, remember back in the surrogate mother controversy when that first came out, where couples that couldn't have a baby, the husband would donate the sperm and a woman would basically rent out her womb. And I talked to both sides, or all three sides, women who did offer their womb up to help a childless couple get the joy of parenthood, the couples who did it, and the people who were opposed to it. And the way I wrote the sections was, every time you read it, you go, yeah, you know, that's really a wonderful thing. That's just great. And then you come to the next part and you go, oh, wait a minute, that's not right. And I wrote very, very strongly all the sides to it, honestly. And the next day, one of my colleagues on the Times, she said, boy, I could never have written that story that way. And I took that as a compliment. But then I realized it was a confession later. And my colleagues didn't really see the need to do that. They would have, you know, dashed off a story and it would have passed muster. Mine was both hard hitting on all sides, and it was the lead of the Sunday paper, send it to the Times credit. So they wanted to fix society, and it slipped very quickly into, well, anything to fix society. And so they made up stuff, they distort stuff, and that's where we are now.
Well, it's the mission, right? The mission changed from reporting to activism, and that's the problem.
I've done investigative stories, and you have an axe there, and you want to make a point, but you have to do all sides. I mean, when people in Illinois were getting their houses, no-knock drug raids, and they were busting in and shooting up places, they were at the wrong address, and people got killed. And I wrote about that, this is back a long time ago, and they actually passed a law to ban no-knock drug raids. I guess they're back now. But I went to the, forget who it was, it must be the drug DEA, or, well, it wasn't DEA then, but anyway, I went to the government people and I tried to get their side. You know, it's a tense, scary time. These drug people are killers, and they kill them each other. And so when you break into a place and somebody goes, hey, wait a minute, what is this? And they just go through and tear up the place. Well, wrong address. But I did get the government to explain the mental set of people that were doing it. And so it was fair. But it's not fair anymore. And I suppose you've got some examples about how the McDonald's episode with Trump on Sunday was distorted. This happens all the time.
Well,
by
first
the way,
off,
I figured out why Joe Biden never did anything like cook up fries and work at the drive-through window. It's because the McDonald's ice cream machines are always broken.
That almost qualifies for a joke of the week, man. There you go. Yeah.
And it was like, when I tweeted that, there was somebody who said, you know, if Trump can get the McDonald's ice cream machines fixed, he'll win in a landslide.
Maybe.
Obviously, they aren't all broken. It's a lie. They just don't want to clean them. Anyway.
Well, but I mean, okay, so let's talk a little bit about the McDonald's thing first, then I'll get to the media angle of this. Now, look, I mean, the guy pulled a shift at McDonald's. And, you know, honestly, I think it was John Podhoretz, who is no big Trump fan, to say the least, said that he doesn't usually, you know, have too much appreciation for anything that Donald Trump does, but this particular campaign stunt might have been the campaign stunt of a lifetime. Because
it's magnificent.
It was really brilliant. He's glad handing the people inside the restaurant, the people on the staff. He's working the fryer. He's, I think, worked the grill, but I know he worked the fryer. You can see pictures of him working with the fries. And then he's at the drive-through window handing people their food and saying, don't worry, I'm paying for it. And there's the one couple comes up there and says, I can't believe I'm just an ordinary guy who gets to meet a former president. He says, you're not ordinary. You're not ordinary.
Yeah, see, that brilliant. He's so good at that. And then he turns around to his shift mates and he says, this is so fun, I could do it all day. There was an authenticity to his enthusiasm and fervor for doing it. When people wanted to talk to him about problems, he let them. And you don't get that with, well, most others. You get others who pretend to do something, but it doesn't work. But he genuinely enjoyed it. And I, you know, I thought that was a big coup. I don't know if it'll last or if it convinced anybody, because the hate for Trump is so abundant in some areas. But in Pennsylvania, you know, it just might swing some over. The people who came up or drove up to the window, you could see the genuine surprise on their faces. They, holy smokes! And they looked at each other in the car. It was a sweet, entertaining moment. He's an entertainer in many ways. Very successful one on NBC with the Apprentice, and so you know, more power to him. Can you imagine if Kamala Harris did that? I mean, she wouldn't do it because she'd look so clumsy and not be able to relate genuinely. He can relate. I mean, to think to say you're not ordinary, that's a compliment. It's a nice thing to say. It's very political.
Yeah, it's a very gracious thing to say, and it's a smart thing to say, because that's exactly, people feel that the elites in this society treat them as, forgettable, and that's
they are, and they do,
and that was, I mean,
and this has been his strength, Ed, since 2015.
He connects.
He connects. There were 17 Republican candidates. Many of them were professional politicians. The only one to connect with the anger and frustration of the American heartland then and today is the Fifth Avenue billionaire. Of all 17, no one would have picked that. But he's so smart. He did it. And he's maintained it. He's worked at his base. Now, I don't think his base is enough to get elected, but I think he needs to reach out more. But it's very effective, very powerful, and he's good at it. He's just so good at it.
So, and this is, I think, the difference, right? Hillary Clinton didn't connect. No. She just didn't, right?
Instead of saying, you're not ordinary, she said, you're deplorable.
Yeah, you're deplorable. Joe Biden did connect, or at least he used to connect, right? And I think he was still riding on that residual connection. Also, there was a response to the chaos that was going on at the time. There's lots of different reasons why.
And he wasn't Trump. I mean, that's a key
fact. He wasn't Trump, right. But Trump is still connecting, and Kamala Harris just isn't. And you take a look at the polls, and you can see this in the polls. The Economist, not exactly a bastion of conservative thought, just came out and said, Donald Trump takes the lead as polls swing away from Kamala Harris. It's the first time in 2 months that he's had the lead in the model. He's got a 54% chance of winning now in the Economist's model of the polls. And I mean, that doesn't surprise me, because I've seen the same data, right? You can see it in RCP. You can see it even in Nate Silver, who weights this stuff. But that's because he's connecting and she's not. And before we get too much to that, I got to talk a little bit about the media reaction to this. First off, there was a bunch of media reports that, well, this was staged.
Well, of course it was staged.
It was staged. Did anybody think that Donald Trump just showed up at a random McDonald's and applied for a job? No, of course it was staged. It was arranged with the owner. It was a media event. Of course it's staged. It's staged just as any other campaign event is staged. Of course it was staged. But he was actually in there working the fryers, ringing people up, handling the stuff at the drive-up. That was actually him doing that. And he was there for at least a couple of hours doing that.
Which shows he enjoyed it.
Yeah, and he did. It looked genuine. Yeah. It could be one of those Samuel Goldwyn things too. And you and I have talked about this. You know, Samuel Goldwyn reportedly said at one point that, sincerity is everything in politics. Once you can fake that, you can do anything.
Groucho Marx. Yeah.
Yeah, or Groucho Marx may have said, I forget who's, it's been credited.
Groucho, yeah. No, it's true. It works. I mean, that's what our politics have become, photo ops. And this was a brilliant, genius photo op. Okay. Now, would it have worked if he was phony? I don't think so. I don't think it would have worked. And no. the beauty of it is that his team knows, and they set these things up. Now, these things don't just happen, as you said. The Secret Service goes to these places beforehand. They check with people. You remember, this is not new to him. He went to the firehouse with pizzas in New York. He went to the bodega in, was it the Bronx, I think, in New York, where the guy got charged for shooting a robber by the same DA that was after Trump. He went to a Wendy's, I think it was Wendy's, in, or no, maybe it was Chick-fil-A. Anyway, he went to a place, a fast food place in Atlanta, and posed for pictures with the people. And then he had one of the women, one of the black women come, and I think was at the convention. It's, we've become a photo op, politics, and the best at it gets credit. And is the best at it. He's just brilliant at that stuff, and his people. For once, well, I think probably it may have been his idea, but if it was somebody else's idea, he at least listened to them.
So the other thing I want to mention out of this, in terms of the media coverage of this, first off, it's staged. You know, I mean, yeah, it's no shit, Sherlock. Excuse my language, but I mean, come on. But secondly, Newsweek decided that they were going to dig deep. They were going to dig deep on this one, Andrew, and they came up with the big scoop that this particular McDonald's had failed a health inspection, I guess recently, their most recent one. They failed it because the employees didn't wash their hands regularly while they were serving food.
Well, I don't think they failed. They got a lower grade.
Well, the way they reported it was they flunked the health inspection, right?
Yeah.
But the question is,
forget it. Doesn't A, matter.
What does that have to do with the price of rice in China, basically? But also B, in their report, they said, we tried to contact the business owner after business hours, but haven't gotten a response. So this was so important that you had to report it without checking with the subject of your supposed scoop. I mean, this is insane. This is not a breaking news item. This is a story about a health inspection violation that could very well easily have waited for a few hours so that you can actually make sure that you got the story correct.
They were so eager to jump on it. And this is one of the subtle things that has happened. Maybe we talked about this before. I don't remember. But this is one of the subtle things that has happened. In the old days, which I'm not saying were better, but they were more judicious, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Editors picked stories that, and they all had biases and so on, but they picked stories that they thought were important or that readers would want to read and know about. Today, importance doesn't matter. Like you just explained, will it get clicks? Will it get views? And that's the only thing that matters. You know, I jokingly at a seminar for bloggers, I once said, well, why don't we just put boobs in every headline and that'll get people to click? And everybody laughed because they knew that that would work. It's got nothing to do with the story. It's all about the headline. And if you can write a cheesy headline that makes people angry or intrigued, they will, if you build it, they will, if you write it, they will come. And it's disappointing, but the good part of the internet, I think, outweighs the danger. But you have to realize that stuff is going online, not because it's great or good or important. It's going online because they want readers, and they can charge for ads. The more people they get, the more money they can make. It's got nothing to do with importance.
Well, you know, I think that older days were probably better days because of that, right? And at least they were more reliable days.
All right, that's right.
I'm thinking about there's a great scene in Absence of Malice, which came out 43 years ago. And it's a great story about how you can get stories wrong. You can be manipulated into reporting things that aren't true. And by unscrupulous people in government. Now, of course, they just skip the middleman and they just are unscrupulous. Media outlets are just unscrupulous on their own. But at any rate, Sally Field, Paul Newman, great movie. for those of you who haven't seen it yet, has the best Deus Ex Machina mechanism in film history, with Wilford Brimley coming in with the subpoenas towards the end. But there's a scene where, in the early part of this, where she's about to write the story about Paul Newman's character with being manipulated into it by an unscrupulous prosecutor, where she's sitting down with the attorney for the newspaper, and he says, "Have you contacted?" I forget what the guy's name is, Gallagher. "Have you contacted Mr. Gallagher for comment on this?" And she said, "Well, we haven't had time." He says, "Well, I suggest you make the time, you know, because that will show that we are being fair and that we are not being reckless with the truth." Somehow that got lost. And Newsweek apparently just decided, what the hell? We'll just be reckless.
And as you said, being used, the Labor Department, and what was the other one where recently where they and the FBI releasing crime news and then stealth editing it, crime news that showed it was down nationally, and then stealth editing it without announcing it to show that actually crime was up 4.9%, violent crime. And then the Labor Department announced that, well, okay, we overcounted 800,000 creation new jobs. And of course, those corrections, those updates are not going to catch up with everybody. So people say, well, no, there's more jobs. Thanks to Joe and Kamala. Yeah. Or Kamala, whatever.
Kamala. Yeah. All right. The Oxford comma law. That's how you can remember. Say Oxford comma law.
There we go.
All right. So that brings us to the jokes of the week, because we're just out of time on this episode.
It turns out I didn't save it, so I gotten it. I don't have it.
Don't worry about that. I have one for you, and I think you'll enjoy this. This is from jokesoftheday.net. I like going over there, just seeing what they've got over there. So there's two guys working for the city. One guy would dig a hole. He'd dig, dig, dig. The other one would come behind him and fill the hole. Fill, fill, fill. Dig, 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 fill, fill, fill. These two men were working furiously, one digging a hole, the other filling it up again. Man was watching from the sidewalk and couldn't believe how hard these men were working, but he couldn't understand what they were doing. So he finally had to ask them. So he asked the hole digger, he says, "I appreciate how hard you work, but what are you doing? You dig a hole, your partner comes behind you and fills it up again. You're not doing anything." He says, "Yeah, no, I know it looks that way." He says, "But there's an extenuating circumstance." The guy says, "What's that?" And he says, "The guy who plants the trees called in sick today."
Okay.
It's just that one little thing that was missing.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
It's so much about government.
Exactly. Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Groaner. That one's a groaner. Jokesoftheday.net. All right, Andrew, the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com. So great to talk to you again today.
You bet. We'll
be back next week, and 2 weeks to go before the big day, you know?
Jeez. Finally. You know, it's almost 2 years. It's the longest one. It's the longest one in U.S. history.
So I just really quickly, before on that note, I'll just share this with you really quickly. I was contacted by somebody, you know, in the business. It's a name that you'd recognize, but I'm not going to say who it was because it's not really material to it. It was responding to something I tweeted out and turned out to be not great, you know, not very well sourced. Anyways, nice about it. You know, you just wanted to let me know, hey, this guy is, you know, not terribly reliable. I said, hey, thanks. I said, how you doing? And he says, I just can't wait for this election to be over. And I said, yeah. Either. The next one starts on November 13th.
Yeah, yeah.
He sent me a very sad face.
Yeah, yeah. Can you imagine? Oh, Lordy. Lordy, Lordy, Lordy.
The next one starts on November 13th, friends.
Oh, boy.
All right, on that sour note, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, at A.H. Malcolm on Twitter. Now we'll say goodbye and we'll come back again next week.
Okay. Thank you, Edward. Thanks, everybody. See you then.